Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In 1929, the Boston Daily Globe ran a story about a prison transfer. The reporter wrote that the inmate would finally, quote, have a glimpse of the world denied him for 53 years. But this wasn't a case of justice perverted or of an innocent man denied his freedom. The prisoner in question was one Jesse Pomeroy. A half century earlier, he'd been imprisoned as the nation's youngest serial killer.
The crimes had been so horrific. I mean, what he had done to that little boy on the beach, it was beyond anything that people could even imagine.
This was 1870s Boston. Pomeroy hadn't even entered his teens when the city was ravaged by the Great Fire of 1872. And it's against this charred backdrop that Roseanne Montillo tells us Jesse Pomeroy's story in her book, The Wilderness of Ruin, a tale of madness, fire, and the hunt for America's youngest serial killer. Now, the stories of young killers are always gripping and disturbing. They are the monsters who lurk behind an innocent facade. We are horrified because they defy reason. Jesse Pomeroy was just 14 when he hacked to death a 4-year-old boy. So we wonder, how could someone so young be infected by such bloodlust? And because it defies reason, it also challenges society's preferred punishments. Should it be the death penalty for a teenager, or lifetime imprisonment, or attempts at reform? Massachusetts wrestled with the moral implications of all three choices in Pomeroy's case. Ultimately, in 1876, Governor William Gaston commuted Pomeroy's death by hanging sentence. And on April of that year, the 16-year-old entered the Massachusetts State Penitentiary. He spent the next half century in solitary confinement. But where does Jesse Pomeroy's story, his psychopathology, really begin? Montillo says there were signs of trouble when he was a very small boy, just 4 or 5 years old, growing up on the Charlestown waterfront. And a warning, this conversation contains some graphic descriptions of Pomeroy's life and crimes that could be disturbing to some listeners.
He was born with a slight defect in one of his eyes that sort of made him unusual from the rest of the boys. So, of course, people tend to pick on children when they have something slightly unusual about them. So very early on, he was bullied from neighbors, classmates, and especially his father. Uh-huh. He was incredibly physically abused by his father.
I mean, you write about how his father beat him within an inch of his life.
Yes, he did. And he especially enjoyed making Jesse strip naked, completely naked, and beat him up.
I mean, it got so bad that his mother tried to kill his father.
With a butcher knife, yeah. Yes. She tried to make life a little bit easier for Jesse, but at the same time, that really didn't go too well with his father. Yeah. So Jesse really grew up having a tough, tough childhood.
Now, describe to us a little bit about Boston at this time.
Yeah, Boston was growing by leaps and bounds. He grew up in Charlestown, so yeah. That was the place where you had people working on the waterfront, you had people who worked in shipyards, you had people who really tried to make it a go, and they were having a difficult time. It was a land of the dispossessed, yeah. The poor, and Jesse fit right in.
Pomeroy was bullied mercilessly. In return, he terrorized younger children. His teachers often reported Pomeroy's behavior to his mother, and that angered Ruth Ann Pomeroy, who wondered why teachers were doing nothing to stop her son's tormentors. But at the same time, she knew something was wrong with Jesse. There were birds with broken necks, missing pets, and then a series of violent attacks on children in Chelsea.
Many, many smaller children were taken away to woods, cabins, and shacks, and he would really beat them up with sticks. He would string them up with rope. He would actually sexually abuse them to the point where he got excited.
I mean, no one knew at the time that it was him who was doing it, but the papers were rife with the story of a boy torturer.
They were. And his mother just read about it, there was something about the description that really made her figure out that maybe, just maybe, her son had something to do with it. But she took him away from Charlestown, and they just moved to South Boston. The problem really wasn't solved. It just moved somewhere else.
You know, I hear this, and the name Adam Lanza strikes me.
Yeah. The difference was, though, that Mrs. Pomeroy didn't know anything beforehand. I mean, there weren't any studies done on children.
Yeah, because this is in the
1870s. I mean, people really had never heard about a child abusing other children. I hate to put it that way, but children died all the time. They had accidents. They were working, so they had accidents at work. I can't tell you how many children died just on railroad tracks. And Mrs. Pomeroy, I mean, what would you do in her situation? It's the 1870s. You're alone. I'm not condoning what she did, but I kind of have to see where she was coming from and the time period where she is as well.
As Montillo says, moving to South Boston changed nothing about Jessie's nature. The attacks on children began again and didn't stop until 1872, when one boy reported to the police that his torturer had a peculiar white patch of skin covering his right eye. That was 12-year-old Pomeroy. He was arrested and sent to the Westboro State Reform School. There, Pomeroy's pathology only deepened. And even if reform were possible, Pomeroy never spent enough time at the school to find out. He was released back to his mother in 1874. 5 weeks later, 10-year-old Katie Curran went missing. Barely a month after that, 4-year-old Horace Millen walked towards a bakery not far from the dressmaking shop run by Pomeroy's mother.
Horace's mother allowed the little boy to go to the bakery by himself, to buy himself a little treat. And he never returned home. That was 10 in the morning, and he never returned home. In the afternoon, about 4 or 5 o'clock, they found his mutilated body on the beaches of South Boston.
Now, when Jessie Pomeroy was finally arrested for these murders, did authorities acknowledge at that time in any way that, you know, beyond clearly his criminality, that there was some mental defect or problem in this teenager?
Yeah, I mean, they knew that he wasn't right, if you will. But still, at the time, you didn't have the exact words psychopath. So they were wondering, is it sort of the nature, is it nature or nurturing that really made him the way he was?
Right. Now, this is a key part of this story that without this analysis, one could just think that this is one of those awful sort of tabloidy crimes of,
you know, became so, yes.
Yeah, like of just like, you know, teenage killer boy infected with evil. You can imagine the headlines as it is. But it's happening in Boston at a time where there's a lot of deep thinking about the nature of the mind itself.
They were, I mean, and everybody had an opinion, from detectives to doctors to people selling newspapers on the street. So they pointed a finger to, of course, his father. They pointed a finger to his schoolmates. They abused him. So in turn, he's abusing others. And everybody, they tried to look back into the family history, and they couldn't find any indication that there had been anybody who suffered from psychosis. There was nothing at all.
And yet there's this great controversy over what his punishment should be, right? There's a controversy of whether or not, even though he was 16, if he should face a death penalty or something else.
Yeah, it was very clear from the get-go what people wanted. They wanted to have him brought to the Boston Common and just let him die. People felt that it was useless to even bring him to trial. Granted, he was 14, but it seemed like the only punishment that one could actually give Jessie was to allow him to die.
But ultimately, that's not what happened.
No. At the time, the governor, Governor Gaston, he didn't like the idea that Massachusetts would be a state that would inflict this kind of punishment on a young boy, because regardless of what he had done, Jessie was still 14.
I mean, this is a remarkable thing that you're saying, that the governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts says, people of Massachusetts, find a little sympathy in your heart for this child who's inflicted with some sort of unspeakable, incomprehensible evil.
Right. And he wasn't the only one. I mean, there were doctors who said, you know, you have a chance here not only to study him. Believe it or not, he's not an anomaly. As horrifying as the case was, there were doctors out there who knew that this was going to happen again.
But no one ever said that he was insane.
No.
They never called him insane.
No, never. So the idea was, let's put him away somewhere. Let's study him. Let's see what he has done. And if, God forbid, something like this should happen again in the near future, let's take what we can learn from him and apply it to other cases.
So Jesse Pomeroy then begins solitary confinement at the age of 16.
2 months before he turned 17, and he was placed in solitary confinement at the Massachusetts State Prison. In a way, he was going back home.
It was so close to where he'd grown up.
Right across. Yeah. So in a way, he was going back home, and he couldn't even see it. I mean, if he had been able to look out, he would have seen his home, the river, the places, the bridges he had crossed. So
let me just ask you briefly. Jesse Pomeroy, as we were saying, starts solitary confinement at the age of 16, spends 4 decades.
42 years in solitary confinement.
So interesting. Because I think some of the most revealing questions are actually asked by in newspapers at the time. Because Jesse gets transferred from solitary confinement after 42 years in 1929 to Bridgewater, right?
Yes.
And at that time, you quote the Connecticut New Britain Herald. Because they describe solitary confinement as the mere process of breathing, eating and sleeping, merely existing amid concrete and steel cells. And then the newspaper goes on and writes this: "But life as we understand it and what we expect of it surely amounts to more than this. Pomeroy, in effect, has been dead for 53 years. He has suffered the pangs of remorse, the stir of conscience, and the pain of thinking about what might have been." And then you ask in the book, had he actually done any of those things?
I think he suffered the idea that he couldn't be outside, but he never showed any remorse whatsoever. Nowhere did he imply that what he had done was wrong.
Now, there's two very powerful threads in this story that I feel like you could actually take the story, change the dates, and put it right in today. I mean, the first is the question of what does society do with these young people who are so clearly disturbed? And you had talked about how doctors at the time wanted to keep him alive and put him in solitary confinement so they could study him. Did any kind of deeper understanding of the mind come from that? Because I feel like the answer might be no, because we still grapple with the same question.
It is the same question that happens today. I talk to quite a lot of psychiatrists and behavioral scientists, and they still don't know the answer what makes someone behave the way he did. What they learned from Jesse at that time was that he was actually not alone, that he was not this anomaly that people had believed, because right after he got caught and right after he was placed in solitary confinement, there was this sort of surge of children who were committing similar crimes. And what the doctors say is, well, stop there a moment. It's not that you have children who somehow caught, you know, a disease from Jesse. It's just the idea that what he did was brought to the public's attention, and now you're paying more attention to what happens around you.
And the second thread that seems so contemporary to me is just this debate on the punishment.
Yeah,
death, solitary confinement, what? I mean, the moral debate is still alive as ever.
It is still going on today. I mean, what do you do with children who are like him? Do you suppose that with therapy, time, and hospitalization, they will get better and they will go on to lead a very normal life? The answer I got from a few people I talked to is no, that you can sort of blunt their instincts, but it will not entirely go away. So, no, so the other possibility is to you put them in prison. And where do you put them? If they're a 14 and 15-year-old, do you place them in the same, you know, prison where you have criminals who are three times their ages and who've done more horrific things. And what happens to them? I mean, do you just have a collection of children, you know, who are grown into prison and just you just leave them there and forget about them? What do you do? The answer is still sort of unclear.
Well, Roseanne Montillo is a professor at Emerson College and author of the new book, Wilderness of Ruin, A Tale of Madness, Fire, and the Hunt for America's Youngest Serial Killer. Roseanne, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
What a story. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.